Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to start off our show by talking about the latest James Bond movie, No Time to Die, which is an ironic title given that they've said from the jump that this would be the last Bond movie with Daniel Craig in it. So maybe No Time to Die, but Time to Move On, certainly. But because of that, I think, they roll out all the stops and endeavor to hit all of the Bond buttons that you are expecting to have happen. There's going to be car chases. There's going to be beautiful women. There's going to be martinis drunk and tuxes worn and daring do. Where do we start with this movie, Mike?
Marie, I'll tell you, where we start with this movie is a number, 163 minutes. this is the 25th James Bond film, and it's by far the longest of any Bond film. And playing off of what you were just saying there, they try to pack everything into this film. And I think it's a mistake. As we talk more about the film, individual plot elements and the overall mood, the overall tone, the fact that there is a kind of melancholic, kind of somber awareness that this is it for Daniel Craig as James Bond. And I don't want to have any spoilers as to how the film will play out, certainly, but you know that going in, that this is, you know, he said the last time he'll play the role. But you know what? On paper, or on computer, if you will, if you read a plot summary, it's got the right elements. This is what you would want in his swan song, if you will. But I'll tell you what, there are a lot of sequences in this film that should be tension-filled, and yet they're so drawn out that it becomes dissipated. Whether it's a car chase or some, you know, criminal caper, or you name it, just fill in the blank there. Any sequence where you think this should be a great James Bond sequence, the elements are there, but what they should do in 5 or 10 minutes, they do in 20 minutes. And let me give you an indication of just how the whole film is bloated. You know, it's quite common nowadays in a film to have a prologue, an opening section, and then maybe a few minutes into the film, then you get the opening titles. And that makes sense, right? Do you know what? I didn't clock it exactly, but pretty close to it. The opening credits occur 20 minutes into the film. I thought, what is going on here? It's almost unprecedented to let that much time go by before you get to the opening credits. And this is no small matter, not just because of the overly long running time, but the fact that, you know, James Bond films are famous for their opening credits. And I thought, well, they weren't at the opening. When are they going to occur? How many hours before we get the opening credits? Marie, tell me your response to that, because it actually was, to me, a telling sign of trouble lies ahead in terms of the structure of this film.
See, I completely expected it, and I think it clocked in at 30 minutes, actually. You start off with, you know, the gun barrel sequence. Everybody loves that part. And then you, like, are thrown headlong into action, and the action's amazing. But they have to beat the last time they did it, you know, like that wonderful opening in Skyfall. I mean, just so surprising and shocking and so much action and fighting and all the things that happen before you even get to what's supposed to be the beginning of the film. So since they're going to pull out all the stops for this one, I think they just went for broke. I thought that was actually the most exciting sequence in the whole movie.
But did it bother you at all that you had to wait, you know, 20 to 30 minutes just to get the opening credits? I mean, to me, there's already, I understand what you're saying there, but to me, there's a kind of imbalance when if it's so drawn out already, what lies ahead? There's a lot of movie lying ahead. I mean, did you have any sense of that? Maybe I'm overreacting to that. And there's no rule that you have to have the opening credits at the exact opening. But when you have to wait, you know, 20 minutes or a half hour or whatever it was, that's a long time to keep the audience waiting before you actually get the official opening credits. And again, for me, that was like a warning sign or a bell or something. But I'm taking to heart what you're saying here, because after all, the opening that we do have really does grab your attention. It's certainly not boring, but the whole time I'm watching, I think, okay, well, how much longer can this chase go on before they cut to the credits? See, I guess what I'm getting at ultimately, Marie, is that for me, it was distracting that way. Even though I should have been totally pulled in by the opening action scenes, I kept thinking, okay, when are they going to cut? When are they going to break and give you the titles?
I was thinking that too, because when it did drag on a little bit, I did think, did I miss them? You know, was I not paying attention? Now, I saw it in 3D, which I thought was fabulous, by the way. You know, all the shrapnel, like, coming right in my face. Daniel Craig shirtless in 3D, the whole 3D thing I like anyway. But it was almost like being thrown into the action, like, instantly, because you really did feel like you were part of the action. So it was like, for a minute, by the time you're ready to come up for air and go, wait, you know, where's the opening title sequence? And then by the time they got around to it, then, I mean, I had already settled in knowing it was going to be almost 3 hours sitting there. So, I mean, I was content to not move for 3 hours. I didn't really care what they did as long as I was entertained. So, no, I didn't have a sense of foreboding, but I do agree with you that some of the scenes, they could have gotten it down to 2 hours had they just edited a little better.
It really, again, I'm determined not to spoil the final sequences in the film, those hours of footage. But I will say this, that coming into the home stretch there, there are places where you want to become the editor yourself, because you see what the dynamics are of, you know, good guy versus bad guy kind of thing, and whatever explosives and chases are involved. But you could just see how they were so into it and so determined to get every Bond element worked into the film that it's just overlong at that point. And again, I was never bored by this film, but I often just times felt like it wasn't as exciting as it should have been. I felt like I was sort of marking time off. Initially, I was marking time waiting for the opening credits. And then, you know, almost a half hour in, yeah, we get them. Okay. We, you know, checklist, we got them. And actually, the opening credits weren't all that spectacular here. They were a little bit of a letdown, actually, because some of the Bond films have terrific openings. I didn't think these opening credits were all that great. Maybe they should have held them until the 2 hour mark. What do you think about that?
They should have just waited till the very end, you know, when we would have forgotten all about it. And then they could have just combined it with the ending credits. That could have saved 10 minutes right there. You know, I guess we're starting off by what we think didn't work, and we're going to move around eventually to what we did like about it. But I have to say, I was disappointed with the song, too. Even though I know this won the Grammy Award for Billie Eilish, I thought it was unremarkable. It sounded like a lot of other Bond themes. So that kind of stuck out to me. What did you think?
Marie, I agree so strongly with that because, you know, in some of the James Bond films, it doesn't have to be Shirley Bassey. I mean, any number of songs going back to Sean Connery days really were a highlight of the film. Particularly, you know, you had the really spectacular credit work, the Saul Bass, you know, and you get all those wonderful effects in the opening credits. And then when you have that title song, I mean, how often when we think of some of those, you know, significant Bond films, particularly back in the Sean Connery era, you remember the songs, right? The Billie Eilish song, I was forgetting it as I was hearing it. It was such a mediocre song. I thought, what a letdown. I mean, you wanted to have something truly memorable since this is, you know, number 25 in the series, since Daniel Craig has said it's the last time he'll do it. And then they get this blah song. I mean, how did that strike you? Because I just thought something didn't quite click here. And I don't care how many Grammy Awards you give somebody. I just didn't like the song at all.
I didn't like it at all either. I think they should have done something that felt brand new. This felt like a retread. But let's talk about Daniel Craig as Bond in terms of this compared to his other Bond films and just this on its own. How did you like him as Bond here? I will say, just to start off an idea, that I was intrigued that he's the only Bond I've ever seen play angry.
Marie, you make a really good point. I've always liked Daniel Craig as James Bond. There is, as you say, an anger in him. There's a rough quality. There's a very human quality in that sense. He's a more three-dimensional James Bond than some of the other actors have been. So I actually was kind of sad when he announced that he didn't want to do the role anymore. And in one interview, he actually said to somebody, you know, I'd rather break this glass, meaning like a drinking glass he had, I'd rather break this glass and slit my wrist than do the role again. But having said that, he really gives everything to this part. I mean, you know, he plays it in full. And from another interview with him, much more recent, where he's talking about this as his swan song, if you will, here's what he actually said in terms of what he wanted to do with the character this final time out. He said, I always just felt, how do these things affect him? Not in like a Hamlet way, but in a Bond world. And you really get a sense of how there's a melancholic, somber tone to the film. There's a lot of leave-taking, if you will. And I think that actually works in the film's favor. Even though I think the film's much too long, that tone, that mood is very successfully established. And Daniel Craig is very, very good in this role.
Yeah, I've always liked Daniel Craig as Bond. And one interview I read with him said that one of the reasons he was hanging it up is as he gets older, it becomes harder and harder to maintain the fitness you need to play James Bond. But I do want to use that as a segue to ask you what you thought of the way they set up future Bond movies in terms of introducing new agents that we hadn't seen before. I did like the fact that he chose the actress who plays Marta from Knives Out to have a role as a character named Paloma. I thought she was a bright spot. It also reminded me of how much I liked Knives Out, which also made me think, they're going to make Knives Out 2. It's not going to be too long before we get to see Daniel Craig in something else. And I thought he was really excellent in that too. So what did you think of the new characters they introduced that I think they are almost certainly going to bring back in subsequent movies?
Well, speaking of Knives Out first, you know, he has shot a sequel to it, so you will get to see that. And also in terms of just what Daniel Craig will be doing, he's scheduled to be on Broadway in the spring in a new production of Macbeth. So he's returning not just to different screen roles, but also to stage work. And so I think that's really good for him. Now, back to the essence of your question, Daniel Craig is now 53 years old. Bear in mind, the film we're watching now, No Time to Die, has been delayed because of the pandemic. It was supposed to come out a year and a half ago. So this has been an extended leave taking for him. And Marie, back to your question there. Yeah, he's really concerned that now that he's the other side of 50, it's a physically taxing role. And he does a lot of his own work, doesn't he? You really see him on screen. So it makes sense for him to want to wind down or pull out of the series. Now, to the real heart of your question, who's our next James Bond? It could well be a Janet Bond, for all we know. Without any spoilers in terms of the actual storyline here, and there's been a lot of speculation, obviously, about who the next Bond will be. With the way this film is set up, the other agents, it could be a woman. It could be a person of color. It could be both. And let me get your thoughts on this, because I think the film is actually very skillful in the way it sets up possibilities from within the film itself as to who might assume that mantle. And in fact, one character actually does briefly become 007 and then hands the numbers back to Daniel Craig, which made me smile. I thought, they're playing with this within the film. Here's our new 007. Well, wait a minute now, because Bond in the film's gone into retirement, right? Now he's pulled out of retirement. And so someone else has taken his number, if you will, and he then eventually does get his number back. I actually thought that was very funny in the film.
I thought that was funny in the film too, but I did wonder during that overlap if the other agent was 007 and a half, 006 and three quarters, just three zeros. That wasn't really clear. I thought they opened the door for some interesting characters in the next movie. One thing I will say, though, that I did think was a miss is that usually each Bond movie gives you at least one really cool villain. And, you know, the quality of the villain, I think, is important because, you know, you have to have something for Bond to, you know, fight against. So what did you think of both Rami Malek and Woody Harrelson as the villains in this movie?
Marie, the short answer to that is I was disappointed, kind of let down. They explain their motives and their reasons and their entanglements with Bond and so on. But you know what? Push come to shove, what's it come down to? A standard issue villain who's into world domination. And the Rami Malek character in particular, I mean, the actor does a capable job with it, but it was the character where I just said, oh, come on, brother, you know, give me a break here. It's just like one more of these where he wants to take over the world. But the thing that bothers me about that, beyond somebody wanting to take over the world, is that in the process of doing so, he'd end up destroying much of the world. So what is the world you would inherit when your very strategy, and again, not spoiling anything in terms of the particulars, but his game plan, if you will, would involve quite a bit of destruction around the world. So what is it actually he would rule over at that point? Like, you would think even a madman would have some kind of logic, some kind of, like, you know, thought out plan, but this just seems kind of haywire, doesn't it?
I also thought it was too much to have two different villains because, you know, when they would go back and forth between the two of them, you'd lose the steam you had for whatever was happening with the last villain that they were depicting. So I think it would have been smarter to pick one. I think I see why they didn't. I think they thought, well, if, you know, this is the last time we're going to have Daniel Craig deal with these characters, we better get all the villains in here and tidy up all the loose ends because, you know, the next Bond might not have the same background story. So I think they just tried to do too much. I was disappointed in both of these actors in these roles too, because they're both great actors who've done better work elsewhere. And here they just seemed like cartoons.
While we're talking about cartoons and villains who are like, you know, out of central casting villains, Christoph Waltz plays another bad guy, you know, Spectre related bad guy. And they're, again, without spoiling the particulars of the story, there's a scene with him in prison. And you know what? The moment that scene, and he's like really obviously a dangerous prisoner and you got to like really keep him under careful guard. I know all that, right? But as I'm watching the sequence, I just kept thinking, Silence of the Lambs. I mean, it really was that sort of thing of, you know, you go into the prison, you go through all the levels of clearance and this and that, and there in the cage is the ultimate bad guy, and the camera goes in closer, and he, watch out, he might want to bite you or something, you know. And I just kept waiting. I thought like Anthony Hopkins would be around the corner, like in the next cell. You know, he and Christoph Waltz could talk to each other. But give me your reaction to that, because that's a place where I thought it was cartoonish in that kind of cliched way of okay, it's actually well shot and all, but how many times in movies have we seen the equivalent scene?
You know, I had the exact same thought when I saw it too, The Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter. Wouldn't it have been just so much funnier if they'd actually had Anthony Hopkins playing like the guy pushing the broom at, you know, while this was going on, because it really was so obviously a reference to another movie. And another movie where it was done better too, because there was no surprise about what was going to happen, because it sort of, you know, sets it up for you. You know he's going to get out. I mean, there's no question, because then there would, otherwise there would be no movie.
See, that's another case, Marie, where the film is referencing all the earlier Bond elements, and then on top of that, all the earlier films with famous villains and so on. In other words, it's like a checklist. And again, in terms of the excessive running time, just take some items off the checklist. And Marie, you make a very good point. It's enough to have one significant villain. When you have multiple villains, it's all those story elements you got to keep bouncing off of back and forth. That takes up a lot of screen time. And I think, again, I keep using the word dissipates. I think it dissipates the energy of the film ultimately. It just crawls along at times. And even though it's fast moving, ironically, it kind of crawls along because it's got, okay, here's villain one, here's another villain, here's a bit of backstory, here's a reference to some other movie. It's like too many cooks in the kitchen. And because this film was so long delayed, you know, I mean, it should have been released in the spring of 2020, they had plenty of time while the film was sitting there. They could have easily done some re-editing. I mean, let me get your thoughts on this. This isn't a case of rushing something into a production release. It's the exact opposite of that. This film's been on the shelf a long time. They could have like watched it again, taken a full afternoon to watch it again, and then maybe done some further editing. I mean, do you think that? I mean, I feel strongly about that they just, you know, they should have known what they had here. And it's making a lot of money. That's not the issue, but just simply the fact that there's too much here.
Yeah, I think there is too much here. You know, you could have actually split it into two different movies. But this was supposed to be the great white hope for the theater industry, that this was going to be the movie that, you know, brought people back into the theater. So if people were counting on this being, you know, an extravaganza to end all extravaganzas and to, you know, have so much hype over, but it's got, you know, Remy Malek in it, and it's got Woody Harrelson in it, and it has obviously Daniel Craig in it. It's got all these people in it. You don't want anybody to be disappointed by not getting enough of what they came to the movie for. So you got to make sure that all the action sequences are there. At some point, you know, mentioning you're alluding to a checklist, at some point in the movie, he has to wear a tux. And at some point in the movie, he has to say the word, he has to order a martini and say, shaken, not stirred. I mean, these things have to be in the script. But you could put all those checklist things in there without having it, you know, go on and on the way it did. I think they were just trying to make sure that everybody knew that they left everything in.
You know what, Maria, in a really tightly constructed scene, it's possible to wear a tuxedo and to have that shaken, not stirred line and all that. You can do all that in a single sequence. But in this film, it's almost like the checklist. Okay, this is the scene where I'll have a tux, and this is the scene where I'll do this or that. It wears so much more efficiently. Part of the problem may go back actually to the origins of the production, where, you know, Danny Boyle was the original director of this film, and he pulled out, creative differences, as they would say, and they brought another guy in. So I think there was a matter of, you know, changing directors, a number of screenwriters working on it. What the expression I used before, too many cooks in the kitchen. I always had the feeling that they just kept adding more and more to the mix rather than taking some of it out or condensing some of it.
Well, I think the last thing I'll say about this before we move on to the next movie is the one reason I could forgive the movie sort of overflowing its purpose is that because it's supposed to be the last Daniel Craig Bond movie, I think they thought people might want to linger. So they let everything sort of extend past what I think would have been a good editing choice. But now we're going to talk about Venom, Let There Be Carnage, which I also saw in 3D, by the way. All monster movies should be seen in 3D, as far as I'm concerned, if it's at all available. And I was the only one in the entire theater watching this. So it was just me and the monsters. And I will say, I thought this felt like two movies, like two screenplays, actually. And then when they tried to throw it together, it didn't really come together. I thought the half of the movie that was a comedy worked really well. And the other half of the movie that was supposed to be a monster movie, I thought fell flat. What did you think, Mike?
Maria, I agree with you very, very strongly here. This film doesn't work for me at all. The basic premise or setup for it, in some ways, genre-wise, would be, think about a director like David Cronenberg. This is definitely not a Cronenberg film, but the point of connection is he works in what's sometimes referred to as body horror. And body horror would be films like Rabid or The Fly, where, you know, I mean, The Fly is a great example, right? You're a human being, and then for reasons that, you know, scientifically are more or less explained, you're human, but you're also something else. You're morphing into something else. And in this film, Venom, it's actually a follow-up to the film Venom from 2018. So we have the Tom Hardy character we've been following, but we have this sense of, for reasons they kind of sort of explain, you've got this monster within you, or monster that manifests. Now, here's, Marie, where I wanted to follow up on your comment as to the disappointment. And I love the way you said it's like almost like two movies, because there are times where you're meant to like really take it, not quite seriously, but still the fact that, you know, this monster's within and can manifest, and not just the special effects possibilities there, but the fact that that's not a very happy situation for the person who has a monster within, right? So there's at least the semblance of some seriousness with that. And that kind of falls flat and just becomes cartoonish. But that relates to then like the other side of it, which is meant to be funny, meant to be kind of cartoonish. And to me, it just seemed like wobbly. And by wobbly, I mean, like, how am I supposed to take some of this? Is it all just a goof? Is it all just like laugh at it? And so on. And you know what I found myself bothered by after a while is that it's really silly. I mean, ultimately, this whole thing, should it be silly or serious, is moot because it's just going to be silly, right? And so after a number of minutes, I was, okay, it's just going to be a goof. It's just going to be silly. Just go with it. But you know what? And this really I found irksome is the fact that it's silly without really being funny. Some of the scenes of slapstick, and I just sat there watching them with maybe the slightest of smiles on my face, but it wasn't like knee-slapping comedy. It was just like, oh gosh, you know, what are you doing? You know, it's like the real obvious, like you know, you're confronting a bad guy and the monster comes out of you and helps you and all. And then, okay, a little bit of fun here. But when you have scene after scene doing that, now the saving grace, if there is one, because I really don't like this film, but the saving grace, is, if there is one, is for a Marvel film, it has a tight running time. We've been talking a lot about running times here. It's 97 minutes long. That's almost unprecedented for any Marvel movie now. They almost always go over 2 hours. And you and I have spent more than 2 hours talking about that. That just, the, you know, one thing after another, you know, climax and anticlimax and whew, I'm worn out. Well, you know what? This film actually, and to its credit, moves along quickly. It has a fairly tight story, if you can call it much of a story, but it's pretty tight. And you know what? It just kind of breezed by. So even though I was really not crazy about this film and honestly just really didn't like it, you know what? It was just a little over 90 minutes and it didn't linger. It didn't dawdle. When we talked about James Bond, you know, how that film is really long and it lingers. This film does not linger. So to its credit, as cartoons go, it's a cartoon that bounces along.
I think of movies like this as visual potato chips. You know, there's no real substance. It's not like you ponder, you know, what they're trying to say for days and days afterwards. It's just something entertaining to watch and hopefully entertaining enough to last through the running time, which I agree, that's actually a perfectly timed movie, in my opinion. 97 minutes is a great running time for movies. Then I love what you say about body horror, because one thing that if you were going to think it through that I thought was an interesting concept is this idea of the monster within. And so that's part of what they play with to some effect, where Tom Hardy's character has been invaded by this symbiotic being, which acts like a toddler and throws all these tantrums and wants to, you know, eat people and, you know, do all the things monsters want to do. And yet there's something kind of Deadpool funny about him and the things that he says, because it sounds like the little voice inside of you that says the things you're not supposed to say. There's a scene where, you know, they've come across some bad guys and of course Venom wants to eat them. And Tom Hardy is, you know, we can't do this. And he says something like, you know, who's going to mind if I polish off a few of these idiots? He's got a very funny, he gets all the great lines. Now, of course, he's also Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy plays the main character, plus he plays the voice of Venom within him. And he seems to be having a ball with that role. He seems to be having a great time. So I thought those scenes worked really well, because the idea that, you know, the dual nature that everybody has, the beast inside of you that wants you to do things you know you can't do, you don't even want to do, and yet somehow you can't make it quiet.
Yeah, Maria, I agree with you very strongly there. It seems to me that it's really to the film's credit that Tom Hardy, plays, you know, the main character and also voices, does the voiceover for Venom. Because you can tell, I love the way you put it. He really is just somebody who is enjoying himself. And you can sense that. He loves doing the monster's voice, right? And this is a monster who's just meant to be a cartoon monster in a lot of ways. Because, okay, eating human flesh, well, the way it's presented is presented funny. But he also enjoys eating two other things, chicken and chocolate. And so, come on, it's just a goofy notion at that point. And it would be, you know, less amusing if it went on longer. But to the point we're both making, there's a real brevity to the film. And that's such an advantage here. So even though I don't particularly care for the film, I didn't mind it. It was just, I love the way he's called it like a potato chip movie. It's just like, you know, just let yourself go and just have some fun for 90 minutes. And it's not going to solve the problems of the world or the problems of monster movies. Whereas the David Cronenberg films, you know, really have more serious intention and are more deeply disturbing. This one is directed by Andy Serkis, who certainly knows special effects and monsters and all that. And I thought he did a really efficient job. That's the word to use as a compliment, a really efficient job of just keeping it moving along, not taking itself too seriously.
I also liked Michelle Williams in this because the scene where Venom, you know, inhabits her and you can hear him go in his voice while she's nodding and you know that he's in there directing what she's saying. I thought that was hilarious. I thought there were moments that really worked in terms of wit, but it doesn't hold up even for the 97 minutes, which brings me to the second part of the movie. What did you think of it in terms of my monster is bigger than your monster and they're going to fight to the death?
Well, you know, I guess it's obligatory to have that sort of competitiveness in the film, but honestly, I didn't care about it that much because my interest in the film is marginal, right? So if it's going to be one monster fighting another one, namely Venom fighting Carnage, at a certain point, I feel like it's a comic book where I just wanted to like turn the page or just, well, let's see how it plays out. I never had, and I think, Marie, this is what you're asking for of me. I never had what I call a rooting interest. I know that among the monsters, I should be siding with Venom rather than Carnage, but I was just like, well, let's just see how it plays out. And I sort of know how it will. How about you? Because I just didn't feel like I wanted to place a bet because I just didn't have enough interest to place a bet.
I was rooting for Venom because I found him endearing early on, even though he's a monster and he wants to eat people and all that stuff. There is something about him that's, well, when he knows that the Tom Hardy character is pining for Michelle Williams. He's like, I'm going to get you through this, buddy. You know, there's something where you can see he's got good human kind of qualities. It also reminded me very much of The Mask, where, you know, Jim Carrey finds this mask and when he puts it on, suddenly he becomes somebody else. You know, something takes over his normally Casper Milquetoast kind of a character and gives him confidence and abilities, strength and power. And, you know, they touch on that idea a little bit in this movie, which I liked, but it did remind me a lot of The Mask.
It does, Marie. And in terms of The Mask, it's just you have to go with the flow, if you will, what I call the silly flow. And a lot of it is special effects driven. You just have to, it's all surface pleasure, if you will. You know what I mean? It's just like enjoying the special effects, enjoying the kind of goofball slapstick comedy. And admittedly, I'm not the biggest fan of that. But I did feel, again, because this film does move along, I didn't mind it. I found it enjoyable. And you know, push come to shove, yes, I wanted Venom to win, you know, certainly, because, you know, among monsters, he's the nicer, or at least the funnier of the two monsters. So yeah, I did have a preference that way, but I didn't really have a strong rooting interest. And I sort of knew how it was going to play out, right? I mean, it's Tom Hardy, and he's going to make it through and probably make it to yet another sequel, don't you think?
Yeah, I think they definitely set it up for there to be yet another one of these movies. But really, I thought it had moments. It was entertaining enough to, I wasn't sorry I saw it. But that brings us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com and on Spotify and Pandora under Dragon Digital Radio. And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.